And you listen to Miss G on the Current Affairs Show today. Okay, so we're going to be discussing if there is a crisis in the NHS today with actual professionals from the inside, which is always very exciting. Dr. Callie and Nurse Rose, hello, how are you doing?
We're fine, thank you.
Hiya.
So we're going to be discussing this topic, which is obviously a very broad topic as well, over the next 2 hours. And there's going to be a lot that we're going to discuss, but we'll break that down. And can we just get a background of where you've come from? So, Rose, your nurse?
At the moment, I work in South West London, in an emergency department, a very busy emergency department. I do some work abroad as well, but at the moment I'm in the UK.
Okay, so you've just come back from Costa Rica as well, is that right?
Yes, or the whole of Central America, really.
Wow, okay, so that's something that we're going to discuss throughout the programme as well, in the difference between certain areas abroad in healthcare and how the healthcare is in this country as well at the moment.
Absolutely.
There's so much going on in terms of in media, in government, but we're going to be talking from the inside because both of you being professionals, you're going to talk about it from your view, which is really exciting and very interesting. Now, Dr. Kelly, could you please give me a little bit of insight to your background?
Yeah, so basically I'm a trained doctor in the UK. I've been working as a doctor for the past 9 years, trained in A&E departments, hospitals. I'm currently working as a GP for 111 service mainly, and I also do some part-time work in dermatology in a big hospital in northwest London.
Wow, okay, so you're very, very busy.
I am.
It's quite exciting stuff because, you know, I mean, we always hear about people talking about it in terms of just generally that don't always necessarily know about it from the inside, the background.
Sure.
Now, for you personally, are you under strain?
I think that everybody's under strain. I mean, A&Es are being advertised nowadays as being under a lot of strain, and that's really true. But I think that NHS is experiencing a crisis throughout, I mean, from community to specialist services, and definitely every system is affected. So, yes, we are under strain.
And this is something I'd like to talk to you about in a little bit, is how we can try and help improve that. And I just need to specify that I'm not a professional in this subject at all. I'm just here to open it up to discussion so that we can have a chat and just find out more information, that obviously this is an issue that affects everyone at some point in their life. So that's why it's very exciting to speak to both of you that are professionals and have seen it from different angles around the world. So thank you to both of you. We're going to be talking throughout the day. If anybody would like to email and ask any questions regarding the NHS, I'm afraid you're not allowed to ask our lovely nurse and lovely doctor here any questions about ailments or anything that's going on, but in regards to national health and what's going on and your views on it, please do email studio@susieradio.com, or you can text 07811 2655 65. We're with you here until 2 o'clock, so please do get in touch. So listen to Miss G here on Susie 103.4 FM, and we're opening up the discussion today in terms of how people are affected in the NHS. Now, let's face it, everyone is affected by this because everybody has health issues and we all have to survive, don't we? And we all have to live and take care of our health. Now, is the NHS under crisis? Is it at breaking point? And how can we find out about this? Well, obviously, people always go to government and look at that. They look at statistics via social media. But we're talking to professionals at the moment in terms of how it is on the inside. And we have Rose here, Nurse Rose. Hello.
Hello.
Hello, how are you doing?
Yeah, not bad.
Good. And Dr. Callie as well?
Yeah.
Now, could you please remind everyone of your certain background and qualifications, and then we'll go from there.
Okay, my name's Rose. I'm a nurse. I work in the ED department at the moment. I've had a lot of experience in burns, in an intensive care too.
Hi, I'm Callie. I'm Dr. Nicola Idu. I'm a GP working mainly for 111 in the northwest area, and I'm also a clinical fellow in dermatology in a teaching hospital in the same area.
Thank you very much for letting us know about that. Now, we had an interesting message that's come through, and this is from Matt in Sussex. And one of the hot topics with the NHS at the moment is the work hours of the doctors and of them being pushed with long hours and being understaffed. Would you agree?
Totally. I think for both sides, really, both nurses and doctors are pushed so far. We're so tired. We're doing a lot of hours, a lot of overtime. Also, a lot of pressure from the fact that people are unwell and we don't have enough staff, so we end up staying for much longer than we're supposed to.
It's a big strain on you as an individual working in the NHS, yeah?
Absolutely, because it's like kind of moral, like, pressure. You have to, because you see how much, especially from an ED point of view, you see how busy it is and how people are struggling and people coming up to you in the corridors. So you can't really say, oh no, I've got to go on my break, I've got to, like, you just end up, yeah, you end up not even taking breaks sometimes.
Could you give me an idea of how long a shift is for you in the UK in the NHS?
Well, for everybody, we all do, the nurses speaking, we all do 12 and a half hour shifts, 13 hour shifts, nights, days, whenever, like going from nights into days. So obviously we have the days off, we have to sleep, so sometimes we are pretty exhausted, but it's better for continuing care in some aspects of doing a 12-hour shift, because you're not handing over all the time and missing out like on communications. So, and we get to know our patients better.
Isn't it really hard for you to go home of a day thinking you've left someone behind there that you've been treating?
Yeah, it is hard sometimes, but you know, otherwise you're never gonna sleep. So you have to. You kind of, when I walk out of those doors, I try and forget about most things, but obviously certain things are always going to stay in my head, and I'll wake up in the middle of the day after a night shift and have to call the sister and. Because I'm worried about something, or
to
did
find
I get
out
that
how your patient is?
Yeah.
Is that what you would do? You'd actually you yourself would physically call up and say, "Hey, I'm worried about, you know, X person." You know,
absolutely. I always if I'm concerned about a patient, I'll always ring in to make sure they're okay. There's been times I've like had a day off and I've promised the patient I'd go and see them and see how they're doing. So we're always checking up. Like even like. I'm speaking on behalf of the paramedics who find the patients, they bring them in, they're in a bad state, they have no idea what's going to happen to them. So they will come in 3 hours, 4 hours into the shift and check up on the patients. I think that's just like having heart, really.
Wow, that's amazing. Now, as I said, I have to keep saying this, I am not professional, I don't know anything about the NHS, I'm literally just opening this up as a discussion and debate. Now, you both are professionals, and that's why you're here today to talk on the inside. So thank you very much, Nurse Rose. We'll be back to talk to Dr. Kelly. You listen to Miss G here on Susie, 103.4 FM, and of course on the web. I hope you're doing good today. Now, this is the Current Affairs Show, opening up to debate for the NHS, whether it is in crisis or not. Obviously, I'm asking you that, what you think. Now, we're actually going to be talking to the professionals right now that deal with people in emergency situations, general practitioner situations, and we're going to be discussing how they feel about it. Now, of course, you can email me your thoughts on this, and if you have any questions on how you think the NHS could be improved. Now, don't forget, obviously, the professionals that are with me today can't change what's going on, but they can tell you how they feel about it. So if you've got any questions, I think this is a great opportunity to actually speak to people on the inside, because let's face it, when you see a nurse or a GP or a doctor in an emergency situation, that's not something you're going to be talking about, is it? So if you want to get in touch, you can. studio@susieradio.com, and you can text 07811 2655 65 and tweet at Susie Radio. Now in the studio joined with me, we have Nurse Rose. How are you doing?
Yeah, not bad, all right.
And we have Dr. Kelly.
Hi.
Now, I want to talk to you about whether there is a crisis within the NHS and how you feel about it. Now, Dr. Kelly, you have a lot of experience. You've come from various different backgrounds.
Sure.
And, you know, how are you feeling at the moment in terms of that? I don't know about this because I said I'm not a professional on this, but is it true that there's around, like, what is it, 2 billion and counting, like, per week or something? Cuts what's going on? I don't know. I mean, you tell me.
I can put this into perspective a bit more, just looking at the facts, and it's nice to use some facts to talk about what's happening. Basically, the current situation of the NHS is that the government is trying to get to use about £2 billion extra and try and inject this money into the NHS. However, I believe the problem is coming from the fact that this money is getting cut from the current NHS budget, so it's like spinning around the money within the same organisation, and actually a quarter of this money is getting spent on transformation. So if you imagine, like, only a quarter is getting spent on transformation and the rest of the money is basically put in to maintain the existing services,
Sorry, Dr. Kelly, can I just stop you there a second? Yeah. When you're talking about transformation, could you please explain what you mean by that in terms?
So transformation will be anything from either employing new doctors, new nurses. Actually, at the moment, they're employing new nurses. In the recent past, about 7,000 nursing jobs were cut because, the idea was if you cut a bit more from here and there, you can deal with it better because you have less money to be spent on the nurses and then more money just to be spent on facilities. So transformation is anything from employing new people or building new services, building online services for patients, online appointments, whatever it can be. And I can explain to you a bit later about that. But the rest of the money is basically being spent on reorganizing an organization which is actually not doing very well. And that's the trouble. And then you have the commissioning groups, which make like the 3 to 5 year plans of what needs to happen as a long-term plan. But actually, I don't feel there is a lot of communication between the commissioning groups and the people who work for NHS. So there could be better things done in that way, like, for example, have national events with the Royal College of Physicians in the country, have the patients themselves go onto the NHS Choices and put down ideas of how they think the best service would be.
So the input from the patients is vital. You want to hear about how people are being affected by this and how they would like it to be improved?
Definitely. And again, the lay public are not basically experts, but they are experts from their own experiences. I mean, there's a lot of demand for various services, including like cosmetic services under NHS. And the government and the doctors and the big governing bodies for doctors need to put down which ones are more important than others. But we need to hear from everybody because it's the public who needs to govern as well, in a way.
It's a professional input too.
Yeah.
We need a better perspective of things because I think a lot of the times the politicians don't really see what it is. And if we want a democracy, we need to have input from everybody, like the NHS users and the Royal College of Nursing and big governing bodies.
Now, talking about healthcare abroad, now, if you don't mind me mentioning, Rose, you're born and raised in England, and Kelly, you were born in
Greece
and came over and studied here and have been here ever since working. Yeah. Is there a reason why you stayed here in England in the healthcare?
Yeah, because basically when I first came, it was kind of a plan from my teenage years, just going somewhere abroad and finding out. I never had a clue about the system here, but I just wanted to escape, let's say, with my friend and just go somewhere abroad. And so I could speak English. England was one of my first choices. And I'm glad I stayed. I mean, the system does work. The education system works. There is another big discussion about how it's working at the moment. But, I'm quite glad I've stayed and I do enjoy my job. But we're trying to find ways on how to improve and make things a bit more ideal and having safe patient care, basically. But I'm really glad. Yeah, that's the reason I've stayed. I enjoy my job, enjoy the country, so I don't think there's a reason for me to go. I've been here half of my life, basically.
So would you say that in terms of that, you've stayed here for a reason because you think the healthcare is good here in England?
Yes, I think that it's marvellous that the UK has a free NHS service. And as Rose said, if you want a democracy, one of the basic things to have is free education and free healthcare, one of the major things that need to happen. And I think we managed with the free NHS so far, and it's really pivotal we keep that public and not privatise it. Because there's certainly ways around we can improve the system.
Because in the States, they've just got it's more like a business. So if you're using money for a drive behind people's health, you're not going to be benefiting the users, are you? You're going to be trying to make money. And I think at the moment we've sold a lot of the NHS off, and we're kind of dismantling it from the foundations. Mm-hmm. So eventually it will collapse. You can't run a free public health system like half and half as a business and not. And they're trying to introduce competition. A lot of the services that are struggling are the ones that are being fined, like for things like in A&E, they have breaches, we get fined. And surely, like, if a trust is struggling, you don't take more money out of it. So it struggles even more. It doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
So you said also as in private companies actually buying into the NHS as well.
Yeah, and it's been happening for years, but it's as I say, it just takes away the foundations of it, and eventually, like, for something like the NHS, where the UK we're all so proud of, because it brought us out of a lot of disease and struggle from like the 1950s onwards, and everybody could get free healthcare, everyone had access, it didn't matter how much money you had. Yeah.
Basically, in regards to healthcare, certainly, well, anywhere in the world, this is something we could talk about for hours and hours and hours. But we will come back in just a second after these ads, and we'll be speaking to the professionals that are here. And Susie, I'm Miss G. This is a current affairs show regarding the crisis, if there is one, or how we're dealing with it in the NHS with Nurse Rose and Dr. Kelly. Like listening to Miss G here on the Current Affairs Show on Susie 103.4. Hope you're doing good today. Now, there's lots of questions that could be asked in regards to the NHS and if there is a crisis. Now, of course, I'm sure everyone that has been to see a GP or has been into the emergency services probably does feel that there is a strain. We are in crisis. But when it comes to actually the professionals that are on the inside working, you see it, should we say, differently?
Well, I think doctors are struggling, really. I mean, if you look at what I'm doing in the hospital, for example, I'm doing long clinics, and the clinics are getting longer and longer, and the double amount of patients is being booked to a single-handed doctor clinic, and they're expecting you to see, you know, at least a third or, you know, more of patients per clinic within this same amount of time. So inevitably, you're going to have longer waiting time because one person cannot see so many people at once. In my GP work, sometimes I was asked to have, on occasions, a double appointment. You know, when you see patients are getting frustrated, I really feel them. And I say to them sometimes to explain why they've been waiting longer. Sorry, but, you know, there's been a doubly booked appointment. So as you can understand, I cannot see two people at once. And that brings us into a very difficult situation because doctors and nurses, we didn't study and we are not working to be put into a position to say that we're not being working hard enough. And so that's why we've been making people wait. Actually, we're working doubly hard, but this is not being reflected because people might think that we're not doing our job properly, whereas it's not. That's not the actual problem. And it's frustrating, actually, yeah.
I can imagine that completely. I really can. Now, obviously, from the other side, you know, I'm not professional, don't know about that, but from what I've seen, people do struggle because you're working long, long hours. You have so many patients. This may be a delicate question to ask, but do you think that we do have, say, an issue with overpopulation, with people coming into the country and using the NHS service?
A lot of the people that come in are working in this country. They're paying taxes, and to be honest with you, we've got the whole MDT, like the multidisciplinary team across the hospitals. Everybody is from everywhere, and it's actually making our NHS better.
So, just to clarify, then in terms of people coming in, like immigration to work over here, it's a huge bonus for the NHS.
Absolutely. And in terms of obviously increasing population due to immigration or we're all living longer.
It sounds so silly. I don't, you know, but is that a strain? Because people are living longer now. I mean, how does that affect doctors?
Yeah, basically, if you look at the national statistics, you'll see, let's say, the total population of the UK was about 59 million 4 years, 5 years ago. And you see that the population is growing by a million per year. This is inevitable because science, medicine has improved. Therefore, people are living longer. Yes, we do have immigration, but I believe the immigration is controlled, you know, enough. I don't think that we should blame people for coming to different countries, or because we should all have the rights to travel and you know, do what we dreamt
of. Of course, definitely, yeah.
I mean, immigration should be controlled because at the same time you need to, you know, care for your own country and make sure that you can provide for the whole population. At the same time as not pointing a finger to the immigrants, we shouldn't point a finger to people because they live longer. I mean, it's insane. you know, the problem, the facts are that the population is growing, people are living longer, so we have less deaths. But, you know, we need to adjust for it. And the only way to adjust for it is we have bigger costs. We have to cover these costs. How do you cover these costs? With many different ways.
Obviously, I know this is probably a question for more of a sort of government issue, and we won't go into the government, but sure. In terms of a viewpoint for you, how can there be more money raised for the NHS? How can cuts be reduced? Yeah.
So basically, again, looking at the NHS England, you see that if you put the same money into the NHS at the moment, in the next 5 to 10 years, you'll be in debt for about 50%, because the costs are rising, because more people are using the service. So you cannot keep the funds the same, but there are certain ways you can find funds. One way of getting funds is reallocating the whole, budget from the UK economy. It's growing. We are growing. Yeah, the economy does. The government agrees on that. But the actual capacity we have in the NHS is not big enough. So we have to inject some money from other sources. It could be taxation. Mm. It could be allocating different resources to different, systems in the UK. The other way of getting them is when you inject this money, you should inject this money for growth. So you shouldn't inject this money to spin them around the same the same organisation which is not working. You shouldn't spin them around the same facilities exactly. You should employ more people. And you should invent new ways. And there's plenty new ways. For example, e-medicine. A big London hospital already, I'm going to say the name just for advertisement issues, but basically they have employed the e-intensive care unit, which like...
Sorry, can I just clarify? What do you mean by e-word?
Yeah, it's like electronic. So basically, all the doctors who work in the hospital, if they have a difficult patient, they need to consult the consultants over the phone. What e-medicine is doing, you have high-definition monitors, and the consultant can see, the specialist can see the patient from the screen. They can say their opinion, and that it's not just something that we imagine it in a kind of idealistic way, but it's proven that the mortality rate has gone down and the length of stay has gone down. So if you spend the money on growth and making the service efficient, then you are kind of saving money in a way.
Is it true that there is a possibility of facing a further 20% cuts?
Are you talking about the general service or are you talking about...
Yeah, I mean on a general, because it's very difficult to actually specify, which from what we've discussed before. Yeah. Could there be a possibility that there is going to be a further 20% cut on the NHS?
I can tell you the GP... Yeah, definitely there's going to be cuts. And the problem is because there's no new money coming from external sources, they're trying to cut the budgets around NHS. They're trying to use this extra 2 billion from the old NHS budget, which is already not enough. If you imagine where... down by 600 million, we're, half of the financial year now. And we are still, we're down on money. And why we're down on money? Because we need more money coming from somewhere to spend it on growth. And if I give you an idea for the GP service, 2005, we had 11% of the NHS budget, right? That was cut down to 8.5% 2 years ago. And despite this, you have the same doctors doing the same things with the less budget on an increasing population. It doesn't really make sense.
And also I think it's management of the money too, because we're losing a lot of staff to, like, obviously the conditions sometimes we're so overworked, and the pay is not substantial, like compared to say agency nurses, which we spent nearly $1 billion the past year on agency nurses, because we have to pay, the NHS had to pay the company, and also they have to pay the nurses, and they pay them 3 times the amount. So a lot of the times we're kind of wasting money when we can think about maybe if we gave more of a pay increase to the nurses that work for the NHS, we'd save lots of money. It's kind of like we cut corners and don't really invest in the future of it.
Okay, now there's going to be a programme on, there's been programmes on every week, there's now actually a programme about GPs behind closed doors. That's really interesting. I watched that and I thought, my goodness. And there's rumoured to be something like 4 million, more than that, patients that they see within a year. Dr Kelly, you're a GP. How many patients on average would you say that you actually see?
So one GP sees a day about 32 patients, 16 in the morning clinic and the other 16 in the afternoon. In between, you have to do a home visit and do your consultations on the phone. So it's about, let's say, 25 patients or so. A total, let's say, of 40 patients a day. So that's in a week, makes already for one GP 200 patients. And if you look at the whole UK, there's been 350 million consultations per year. And actually, what's shocking is like 10% of this amount, like 34 million patients, failed to see a GP in 2014. And why did that happen? Because you have complicated cases you need to see. You cannot see a patient with a complicated issue within the 10 minutes. You have to offer another appointment. So the consultation rate has increased. It used to be 3.9 consultations per person per year. Now we're gone anything above 5.9 or whatever. So these people are going to take more spaces in your clinic. And then you have the younger population, which, you know, needs appointment, that cannot find an appointment. And that's another thing that is letting people down.
Well, there's been an email coming through. Is how can you actually expand on the actual surgery, getting more doctors in, more nurses in? Okay. How can you do that, and how can you get more beds in hospitals?
Okay, that's another big discussion, isn't it? So basically, if you inject money, you're going to spend it on few thousand nurses, few thousand doctors. That can be done by finding the right budget in the right way. But you know, when we need extra home care workers in the community for elderly people. If you get all these GPs, you have to accommodate for space. The same goes to A&E. So many A&Es have been closed down, turning these big building hospitals into rehabilitation services in a way. And the rest of the hospitals who have kept their A&E, they have another population, doubling their own population, directed to the A&E with limited space. Mm. So you are seeing double the people in the same space. Even it's such a physical restraint. You cannot see people. There are not enough rooms in A&E to see them all. It feels like World War. I mean, you know, you need more space. You have to rebuild your building if you want everybody directed to one.
So if we got more money in the system and we made more hospitals and rebuild and trained more, we would have essentially be under less strain, yeah?
Yeah, but again, this is something that the government knows even better, because they need to work out if it's more costly to build a bigger building versus closing an A&E. So if that's more costly, then obviously they need to extend the building. If it's less costly, they'll do that this way. If it's more costly, then they need to reopen the A&Es.
Well, it's a very scary thing, because there are quite a lot of I mean, I may be wrong here, but from what I've seen and heard, a lot of A&Es that are closing down in certain areas. I mean, how do hospitals cope when they close down an A&E?
Yeah, they don't cope. Yeah, I mean, you see the patients, and what happens now? You admit a certain amount of patients. If you end up with bed crisis, meaning you have no beds, you imagine if you have sick patients, you have to direct them to the hospitals that don't have A&E, so there'll be ambulances taking these people. That's extra money. So, you know, they try their best to, you know, reduce the length of stay. And as a GP, I find, and basically working for 111 mainly, I find that I go to patients' homes with so many failed discharges, not very good plans, and then I have to readmit them with an infection which might have, which has worsened in the community, because it was partially treated because of the rush. So you end up to square one, really. I mean, you haven't really treated it properly, unfortunately. But that doesn't go to everybody. I don't want to say, because I want, you know, NHS does work. It's an excellent service, but there's so many mishaps that we need to improve on.
Absolutely. Now, this is something that we could talk about for hours and hours and hours. Now, of course, we're here until 2 o'clock. So if you do have any more questions for Dr. Kelly and for Nurse Rose, you can email in studio@susieradio.com. We've got quite a few come through, but we'll go through them as much as we can while we're here with our professionals. So please don't get too upset if we don't get through your questions, but we'll try to do as much as possible here on Susie. We're joined by professionals from the NHS right here in the studio. How are you doing, Rose? And Dr. Kelly?
Hi, thank you.
We're talking about the NHS. Now, I have to keep mentioning this, it is important. I am not a professional. I'm here just to open this up to discussion, but I do have two professionals in the studio at the moment. I have a nurse who has been travelling around the world, actually, with her qualifications, helping people in the UK and abroad. And we have a doctor that's born in Greece and moved over to the UK and stayed here because she loves the healthcare and working in the healthcare in the UK, Dr. Kelly. So thank you very much for that and looking after us all, both of you. Now, okay, so Britain's National Health Service has said to be classed as the best out of 11 world's wealthiest countries. Now, do you agree to that?
Yes.
Totally.
Yeah.
So you have experience from working abroad and working here. I know this is very difficult to generalise this. How does it differ?
Well, it depends whether you're in a developing country or a developed country, but I've mostly worked in developing countries like Vietnam, Fiji Islands, and I've had some experience in Central America too. They're normally based on a system which has like half private and half public. Basically, you really need to go private because the public hospitals are just generally sometimes absolutely awful. Sometimes the doctors are paying for the vaccines for the patients and they're on nothing as well.
So just to clarify that, the doctors are actually going out the way to help them and taking money out of their own pocket. So in a way, they're helping as an aid crisis. Yeah. It's a reversal.
It's like humanitarian aid, really, because it's diseases like diphtheria, which don't even really exist in this country anymore, and they're the ones putting their hands in their pockets to help these people, and it's madness in these hospitals. There's free people to bed. There's people with their families. In Vietnam, I had people cooking noodles in the corridor with their families whilst waiting to be seen.
Could they not provide food? Do they not have enough money to provide food for their patients?
No, absolutely not. They totally rely on families. They're always with them. But however, in this country, I think people are starting to become a bit isolated from their families and the support network, especially the elderly patients. A lot of them don't really have relatives that visit them much and don't help them out. And that also puts a strain on other care services.
This is a really interesting thing. So basically what you've seen from being, say, for an example, you know, Vietnam, where people don't have even food, they're not being supplied food. Their families are having to come from the outside into the hospitals and provide food for them. Whereas in the UK, people are moaning about what kind of food they're served in the hospital. And really, we're very lucky, are we not?
Yeah, I try and explain this to my patients in the most nicest way, but we are so lucky here. We get people coming in, like, as soon as they've sat in the waiting room, they're like, I want a sandwich and a cup of tea, and it's... we try and accommodate them, but we end up doing everything for them, and I think sometimes it makes them a bit too reliant on the service, and I think that's what's... I think we need to change the mentality and try and educate people to like look after themselves and not expect everything.
Okay. Now, you've just come back from Costa Rica as well. How was it over there in terms of, were you actually there as an aid worker, as a medic? How did it work for you when you went over there, and why did you go over there as well, Rose?
I saw how their health system worked, and if you really want any sort of healthcare, even if it's basic things we don't think about, like health visiting for the locals who have had babies and vaccinations for the kids. They have to go to the capital city, which is San Jose, which is sometimes like nearly an 8-hour trip for them, and they can't really they can't afford that, and it just makes things really difficult.
So potentially they can lose patients because they have to travel 8 hours to be seen in an emergency situation.
Yeah, it's the same in Nicaragua. Like, If somebody is unwell and it's a serious condition, they've got hours and hours to travel, and most of the time they lose them in the ambulance. They don't have things like... unless you can pay for it, they don't have helicopters to rescue them from, say, the islands as well. You don't think about the isolated environments they're in. So I think they're severely lacking on, like... our primary care is fantastic because we've got all this access in our communities. We don't need to even go anywhere.
Well, I mean, in regards to 111, I mean, Kelly, you work for that, so people can actually phone up before they think, okay, do I need to call 999 for
exactly,
an ambulance,
yeah,
or whatever?
Yeah.
So people can call you
for anything, from the most serious thing to the least serious thing. It could be a temperature an hour ago or some kind of trivial thing, and it could be something really sinister. We need to call the police or the ambulance straight away. So it could be anything really, but they can call for anything, yeah.
So you would then, in a sense, sort of advise people to call 111 if they don't know whether they necessarily need an ambulance, because then that's reducing the strain somewhat?
Basically, I believe, like Rose said, that education is really important, and how education starts is from ourselves as health professionals. So to do this, though, you need a bit of time. Sometimes I'm trying to be opportunistic and say, not in a judgmental matter, but to say, well, we are an emergency service, and unfortunately I cannot prescribe this for you because this is supposed to be something you can get from your own GP. So I'm trying in the best of the way to direct them to the right services for the future, so it reduces the amount of calls. But I think GPs should play a major role in educating patients, but when you you're seeing patients within 10 minutes and you have such a rush, and it's not an excuse. Yeah, we try to do our best, but having to deal with targets and codes all over the place, you know, it's getting difficult. That's why we've been saying we need more doctors and nurses around. Mm. If we could educate people, how much is it to call for an ambulance versus taking a taxi yourself to go home?
So on that note, I mean, is there a possibility? I mean, I've heard sort of along the grapevine rumour that there is a possibility of GPs having to work the extra, even more longer hours, because there's a possibility of, say, extended surgery hours of the evening during the week, and also possibility of opening up the weekends. Is that
true? I think there is a pressure towards this, because basically, if you don't agree to the service extending the hours over the weekend, then you're going to lose some funding. So it's, you know, a few thousand pounds you're going to lose from your funding to your own surgery. So people, and because obviously we live in a busy society and people cannot find an appointment, you know, can't get an appointment on time. Most people work until 5-6 and then, you know, they contact 111 for something trivial rather than, you know, waiting until the next day, for example. But most of our calls, to be honest, on 111, they are quite valid to be done, but let's say about 20% are for routine matters, and then people need to be directed to the right place. But the idea is to the GPs to extend the surgeries over the weekend, do like a shift pattern work, and try to accommodate these patients they cannot see during the working hours of the week.
Okay, that's fantastic. When you think about it then, we have a very positive outlook when it comes to that, because Rose was just saying, coming from abroad, you know, you might have to travel 8 hours to get to a hospital. Over here, someone can call up 111, speak to you and say, right, okay, maybe I don't need to call 999 and actually reduce the service of that. Or then people can call 999 and we have bicycle services, we have helicopters, we have ambulances, we have the car services when the medics come out before the ambulances get there. In a sense, we're very lucky that we have all of these resources in the UK. So, okay, yeah, we're under crisis. We do have a strain in the NHS, but we do also have a lot of resources as well, and we should be very thankful for them, yeah?
Of course of course, that's true, yeah.
Brilliant. We don't want to lose them, that's why.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, this is what we've got to keep going. Susie, 103.4. Fantastic. Listen to Miss G here on Susie. How are you doing? I hope your Wednesday's going well. Hello to Annette, who's listening in. I hope you're having a good day, so she's enjoying the show. We're joined by two very good professionals that are working within the NHS system. That's Dr. Kelly, and we have Nurse Rose as well. Thank you very much for joining me today.
You're welcome.
Really appreciate
it.
You're giving me some really good inside facts. Now, talking about the education, like educating people so they know more about the inside facts regarding the NHS, how can you educate those more as a sort of summary?
I think stop Googling diseases and becoming very worried, and just learn a little bit about these conditions, not being so anxious about things. I think the trouble is we end up, the people that need the service are too proud, and because they've been through the Second World War, and they don't come in, and then the people that use the service over and over again are people that they can manage these conditions elsewhere, like minor injuries clinics, or like, even I know a lot of the times you can't get an appointment with the GP, but a lot of these problems are GP problems, and they expect us to be able to solve their problems, but we work only on an accident and emergency. You know, we deal with the problem there and then. We can't deal with MRIs or anything like that. We can refer, but nothing else.
So this is only in terms of, say, if someone's coming in from an accident or something that's quite severe, in terms of that, then people would be sent through for scans and things like that, because you'd have to, because it's on an emergency basis. Yeah. Is that what you mean in terms of that?
Yeah, basically.
But, I mean, if someone's coming in with a generalised problem, you can't just go, oh, actually, you know, all right, then we'll go and get you an MRI and see what's going on. That is when you would be referred to, or say, look, please go and see your GP. Is that how it would work?
Yeah, because we don't want to waste their time or our time, you know? Like, if it's a problem that's been going on for months and months and they're already being investigated, there's nothing, unless there's a new and acute problem, we can't deal with it there. And trying to explain that to people, we'd wish that we could do that, but that's not the service that we provide. We provide accident emergency, it's in the name, you know. It's
yeah, okay. I totally agree on this, but I think education comes from everywhere. I mean, internet is good only if you use it the right way. So what I try to educate my patients on is which websites to look for for one thing. So there's valid websites like the patient.co.uk, which is a very good website where you can look up some symptoms and get an idea of what it might be, as opposed to random forums which, you know, mention cancer all the time and half of the conditions are cancerous and then therefore patients are getting too worried. Yeah. So education comes from, should come from all aspects. In a way, we're educating today from the conversation, in you know, because we come from the insides, and I think talking about facts is important, and this way people can be educated on, for example, how many missed targets we had this year or how many good targets we had. So I think it should come from everybody, and empowering patients to, you know, act for themselves in situations that are not a nursing situation and can wait for the next day.
Okay, so in a sense, you can work alongside each other saying, look, you know, please, this can actually help with the strain. So it's not just the situation with the cuts and the money and how much is needed or that is being lost. It's actually how the patients look after themselves as well, in terms of them knowing, being educated where to go first. Is that kind of the way forward?
Yeah. I mean, in all aspects, when you see a patient, no matter how trivial a condition is, you also safety net them, we use this medical term, saying you always have to tell them what signs to look for, which signs are an emergency, and what they need to do in that way. If they don't have the signs, basically they shouldn't come to A&E. So, you know, from this aspect, you should always warn them, because they need to be educated. They're not doctors themselves. So we cannot, you know, in a way, blame them for coming into A&E because they're worried about something. But if you educate them, and that, I think, even in public school in the UK, children should start having some health education there, or, you know, in some way putting that through them and to be part of the culture, rather than, you know, educating one by one in the A&E service, which you cannot catch the whole population like this, but yeah, we're
absolutely
trying to help.
I think that is actually a brilliant way of dealing with this. If schools could actually implement some sort of education where people think, okay, hey guys and girls, don't worry so much. These are certain symptoms to look for certain things, or just even educate them on where to look online, because let's face it, the world is online these days. And like you said, go and look on websites that are, you know, for the educational purposes, not just where people are going to get concerned and paranoid about things.
Yeah, I mean, education is, as you say, rightly say, it's not just about the disease itself, but it's actually how to prevent it.
Yeah.
So young patients with sexual health problems or whatever, not, you know, practicing safe sex, which I sometimes come across quite often. You know, if they had this kind of sex education at school, you know, preventing disease is the best thing. And if you actually, if you can prevent disease, you can, you know, you can gain money in the NHS, because we should be making a profit rather than being in debt. At the moment, we're in debt, and that's the issue.
We're discussing the crisis of the NHS and whether it is actually in crisis, and how we can educate people to deal with it, and how it's all run from the inside. Joined by two professionals, we have Nurse Rose, who works, well, she's worked in many countries around the world, and she works in A&E under pressure. And we have Dr. Callie, who has worked around many, many places all around the UK, really, haven't
yeah,
you?
That's right.
And also abroad. And you have a very, very broad spectrum of qualifications, and you deal with very different things, and you're doing a lot of different things within the NHS and also privately as well, because we were talking earlier that you work for 111.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, so that is a service where people can actually call through if they want to get any information before they call 999.
Yeah.
I mean, how many people do you think on an average would actually think, okay, I'm going to be sensible, if they're not, obviously, unless they're sort of, you know, going through something very, very serious, and they, you know, when you really know you need an ambulance or something like that, an emergency
yeah.
situation.
Yeah.
How many people do you think are sort of sensible enough to sort of take the strain off and call 111 instead of actually using up the resources in an emergency situation?
On average, I would say, I mean, an emergency is not only an ambulance need to be called or the police. If a patient, for example, has an infection, which you think they need to be seen today, that's another kind of an urgent call for us to invite them to the clinics or do home visits for them. So it's not strictly, they shouldn't contact 111 if it's only strictly for ambulance reasons, but they should contact us for any kind of healthcare health problem which needs to be looked at as an out-of-hour service. So if they're really ill, they should call 111. If they're not sure, of course, they still need to call us because they need to get some direction. But as we said earlier, with the right education, we hope that we educate our patients to use the services in the right way. So in other words, if a regular prescription needs to be given, that's really something that the regular GP needs to deal with, and it can wait until the next day. Again, it depends on the nature of the prescription. Or, for example, if it's something that is not that urgent, can wait until tomorrow. Yeah, okay, it can wait until tomorrow. So if you have an earache and you have no fever and you can wait until tomorrow, you get some painkillers and it can wait, then really you should really be seeing your GP the next day. But again, the problem comes because there's not many GP appointments. Every time I'm trying to speak to patients about, you should be going to your GP, for example, in the nicest possible way, they're like, it's really hard for us to get an emergency appointment because there's so certain slots to be filled in. And once these slots are filled, then again, there is patients who come to us because the number saying that 34 million have missed an appointment in November. So these people have to come through 111 then if they cannot see their own GP.
So are these some of the patients that have appointments that haven't turned up? Is that how you're saying the estimate of people that have missed their appointments?
No, it's people who have missed the appointments because there were no spaces for them, or people who have cancelled appointments, for example, without letting the service know soon enough so we can refill them with someone who really needs them.
I have a question. This is something that happened to a friend of mine a few weeks ago. Now, she couldn't go into work for a couple of days, and they were very, very, very strict through HR, saying that she had to have a doctor's note. So she therefore had to take up an emergency appointment to get a doctor's note. I mean, obviously, that's coming from whatever, business environment. How does that then affect you, someone that needs to see a doctor for something that could be potentially really important? I mean, how can we help with things like that? How can we change that?
Well, sometimes you cannot change it because, as you say, some employers, I mean, everybody knows that they can self-certify within 4-7 days. But as you say, there are certain employers that are a bit stricter. And actually, as a patient, you don't have a choice but to see a doctor because we cannot really give a sick note over the phone. We have to see someone and make sure that they're actually sick for the thing that they are saying. Because if you look at the sickness days, it's not to do with your friend now, but in general, because of ill health and missed working days, there is so many missed working days in a year, which costs us about £10 billion. So, we can do better on these things by educating them. But, of course, in some cases, you cannot avoid it. Therefore, that's why you need more doctors.
How do we get more doctors?
We need to get more money in NHS and use it wisely.
Sounds good. Okay, well, we're going to stay on that and we're going to summarise how we can educate. Talking on a serious note about the NHS and whether there is a crisis or not, joined by two professionals, Nurse Rose and also Dr. Callie. How are you doing, ladies?
Fine,
very
thank
well.
You.
Yeah.
Now, earlier on, we were talking about how we can educate people in terms of, patients, potential patients and people just generally. Because the NHS, let's face it, we all need it. We all use it. At one point in our lives, we're going to end up somewhere in A&E or seeing a GP. So how can we maintain it? How can we look after it on this side? And also from the view of a doctor and a nurse that works in the profession, how do you guys deal with it?
Do you want to go first?
No, you can go.
Oh, fine. Okay. So you're asking me how do we deal with it as a person? You mean like?
How do you cope?
How do I cope? Well, you have to have your own life. You have to be fit for your own job. So for people who work double the hours or extended hours, they have to be not tired. So they have to get good sleep. At the same time, you have to keep your life and work balance because you cannot go home thinking about all your patients, like Rose said, and having, massive guilt about not being able to do some things that you weren't able to do. So you have to keep it balanced. But at the end of the day, that's why we're talking about the crisis, because we're in crisis and doctors and nurses can get burned out. And at the end of the day, as we say, it's all about patient care and good care. And if doctors are getting burned out and nurses are getting burned out, they cannot give as efficient care as the government is planning to have.
I totally agree. And I think that's the best way to sort of summarise that in that way. Now, we're coming to the end of the show. So how could we summarise actually educating the population that go and use the NHS services?
Obviously, the preventative medicine, I think, is one of the most important things. And the NHS and introduce a lot of posters around GP surgeries, lots of leaflets giving advice. I think we need, yeah, we need to focus a lot on that, and I think that that would be a good investment for the future. But also, it's, yeah, it's management of the hospitals. It's a number of things. I think we all need to work together to try and help this. I think the government needs to support this though too, because we do need that funding also. But we're losing a lot of doctors and a lot of nurses due to the fact that they are burnt out, and they're good professionals, and we're relying so heavily on sources, private sources like agencies and locums. So that's a huge impact on our service.
So you need to have more people so you can actually space it out, have more of a rest to come back and do your job. Yeah. Fully, yeah.
Yeah, and to stop like closing departments around London, around the country, really, and it's because it's putting a big strain on other A&E departments, other wards. We need more beds. We need expansion. We're a society that's growing. We're civilized. We need to expand the hospitals a bit more, and we need a lot more funding pumped in.
I totally agree. I mean that. Keep things going, keep things alive. If you've got the money, please put it into the system so we can help our professionals that work very hard to look after us. Thank you, Rose. I appreciate that. And Dr. Kelly?
Yeah, so that's I totally agree with that. And then we live in the UK. We don't live in an underdeveloped country. We have big research going on in the UK. We work with pharmacies and big research companies. We know as doctors that there is new systems in place to help people manage certain diseases at home, like kidney patients. We can do dialysis now at home. They can do blood dialysis at home. We are evolving. So all these things, if the right machines are put in the right places, then we can cut on beds, we can cut on lengths of stay, and we can educate patients how to deal with their own disease themselves. So that's another good way of putting it. And also, if we want wage freezes, yes, do the wage freezes. I wouldn't mind if my wage was frozen, but if I had enough hands around. But I'm not happy if I have my wage frozen and having to do double the job, because at the end of the day, that's not fair. Not just money from the money point of view, but from an ethical point of view.
And also for the fact that you've gone through so much education to get where you are today as well, right? And you should be compensated for that.
Yeah, but, at the end of the day, as we say, I don't think we all work, and we studied medicine and nursing to help people, and we are still doing it, but we just need a bit of help of getting more hands around.
I agree. So ending this on a positive note, yeah. Both of you enjoy working in the NHS.
Yes, I do. It's totally for my morals. I'm totally public health. You can't have a business profit motive behind health, because it just can't work.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, democracy is a big thing, and democracy should be done in practice and not just in theory. So I think we should fight to achieve that.
Absolutely fantastic. Thank you so much for being joined with two professionals from the NHS. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much for giving me and us your time today, because you do it every single day on your job. You spend many hours looking after everyone, and you've taken time out today on your day off to come in and talk to me. So thank you both of you so much.
You're very welcome.
Really appreciate it.
That's fantastic that we've been joined by the professionals here to talk about the inside crisis on the NHS.